So welcome to Israel, Yerushalayim. I hope this will be a wonderful experience for you. You're all from South Africa, all the same?
One from Australia.
Australia, okay. So welcome. And for some reason, I don't know what's going around. There seems to be some virulent flu or cold that's going around. Everybody is sick, so I hope you don't catch anything if you haven't already caught it and the like. So one thing we're going to talk about today is a little bit of history, and it's interesting that even people who learn in yeshiva a lot are often ignorant of a lot of history. So, for example, we know the story of somebody once asked their Rebbe, who lived first, Shmuel Aleph or Shmuel Beis? No. So the Rebbe answered, well, which temple was first, the second temple or the first temple? You know, so people don't always have a sense. So since you're going to be seeing those aspects of the old city and the temple, you went to the tunnel?
Tunnels.
You're going to see the tunnels and the like. So I just want to describe this a little bit. And I'm not going to overwhelm you with a lot of dates, because number one, I don't remember a lot of dates myself, and number two, too much detail will bore you, and you'll hear it from tour guides who are much more knowledgeable than I am, but I want to give you an overview of the general idea. We know that it's very, very interesting that, you know, how many years were the Jews in the land of Israel before they even built a temple? Remember, they came under the time of Yahushua, after the 40 years in the desert, and although there was a temporary sanctuary in Shiloh and the like, but the temple in Jerusalem was not built until Shlomo HaMelech's time, King Solomon's time. And the Navi himself, the Book of Kings, actually tells us that the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, was not built, or it was completed in the, this is a very critical date in to reconstruct biblical history, 480 years after they left Egypt. Now, since we know they wandered 40 years in the desert, so that means they were in the land of Israel 440 years before they built the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. And that's pretty strange in a way, because actually, according to the Rambam, there's a mitzvah in the Torah to build a Beis HaMikdash. And we do know that the Beis HaMikdash is ultimately in Yerushalayim. This is the, by the way, where does the Chumash say that? The Chumash never says you have to build a temple in Jerusalem. It always says, "Hamakom asher yivchar Hashem." You will build the Beis HaMikdash in the place that God will choose. It never says that it's Jerusalem. And that, in fact, might be the answer to our question, that God didn't tell them where to build the temple till after all those many years. You know, the Rambam says a very interesting thing. The Rambam says in the Guide to the Perplexed, why doesn't God say where he wants the temple to be built? Why is it always HaMakom HaShem Yivchar HaShem? By the way, that's why the Beis HaMikdash is called Beis HaBechira, the chosen place, HaMakom HaShem Yivchar HaShem. So the Rambam says the following. The Rambam says that if we would have known ahead of time that the temple is going to be built in Jerusalem, then the tribes would have fought which one of them gets Jerusalem. Since they didn't know, so they were willing to accept the division of the lands, that Yerushalayim, as you know, is mainly in the tribe of Yehuda, and the Beis HaMikdash itself is bifurcated. Part of the Beis HaMikdash is in the portion of Yehuda, part of it is in the portion of Binyamin. But the Rambam says, had they known ahead of time that that would have been the place that God would choose, nobody would give it up at all. Again, the Rambam's a little difficult, because it seems from many Midrashim that everybody knew Yerushalayim was the holiest place. This was the place that Adam was created from. The dust was from that place. This was the place where Yitzchak was brought as a sacrifice. So it's not like this came out of nowhere. It's like that they didn't even know this was holy. So the Rambam's a little difficult. The Rambam is actually suggesting that they were clueless until the time of King David, when God said, you know, the temple's going to be in Jerusalem. But okay. But be it as it may, God first indicated there would be a temple in Jerusalem only in the time of King David. But King David himself was not permitted to build the Beis HaMikdash. And you remember why? Because God said, you are a man of war. You are a man of bloodshed. And although your bloodshed was a mitzvah, and you were fighting the enemies of Hashem and protecting the Jewish people, but violence cannot be the basis of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash has to be built on a basis of peace. And that is why it is only your son Shlomo who is a man of peace, there will be no wars in Shlomo's time, that is able to build the temple. Moreover, I do want to point out a very interesting thing. The city of Jerusalem was conquered by King David. There was a war. He conquered Jerusalem from the Jebusim. But the Temple Mount itself, just the Temple Mount, was not conquered. It was purchased. At the end of the book of Shmuel Beis, David HaMelech approached a fellow called Aravna, that was his name, Aravna the Jebusite, Hayavusi, and he bought the land. In other words, he conquered Jerusalem, but the Temple Mount had to be bought. And again, the idea is that everything connected to the Beis HaMikdash has to be based on peace, not based on war. Shlomo, not David, purchased. David, by the way, drew up all the plans for the Mikdash, purchased, and not fought. This has some implications today, you know, without getting into the controversies. You know, there are a group of well-meaning Jews who actually feel that we should take the initiative in building the Beis HaMikdash even today. Because they base it on some statements that say that we should build the Mikdash and that'll bring the Mashiach. As opposed to the Rambam, who says the other way around, first Mashiach comes and he builds the Mikdash. I just want to point out, though, that in a way, the Rambam's Shita makes a lot of sense. It's consistent with the Rambam's overall interpretation of this. Because if we were to build a Mikdash today, it would come as a result of really military action. They say, bomb the mosques, get rid of the mosques. And putting aside, you know, that'll probably cause a nuclear war, but whatever, their position is, if we do it, Hashem will do a miracle. But the Rambam says the other way around. The Binyan Beis HaMikdash has to come through peace, so when Mashiach comes, the nations of the world will acknowledge the God of the Jews as the only God. And they will encourage us. Well, Rashi says the temple will come down from heaven. The Rambam says Mashiach will build the temple. But the point is, when Mashiach comes, the Beis HaMikdash is not going to be built through war. It will be built through all the nations of the world. Now, we're not going to let them actually contribute to the building. That has to be a Jewish thing. But they will support it. They will glorify it. They will pray in that temple. The temple will be a house of prayer for all of the world. This is a very interesting point, and it actually has political repercussions even today, how we deal with the Temple Mount and the like. But be it as it may, so the first temple was built by Shlomo HaMelech, although David HaMelech gathered all the gold and the silver and the raw materials, and this was a magnificent temple, and that temple lasted for 410 years. Now, a lot of things happened in those 410 years. Perhaps the biggest thing that happened until the destruction of the temple itself was that the Jewish people split into two different countries. After Shlomo died, his son Rechavam wanted to be tough. And you may recall, if you know your biblical history, that 10 tribes split from the two tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. And the 10 tribes started a northern kingdom that was called the Kingdom of Israel, the Malchus Yisrael. And in the south, around the temple, all there was Yehuda, Binyamin, and the Kohanim and Leviim were basically centered around there. And there were times that these two kingdoms lived in peace with each other. There were times they had civil war. Technically, it wasn't even civil. I mean, religiously, it's civil war because they're all Jews. It's Jew against Jew, and that's a sad, tragic thing. But they were two different countries with different alliances. Now, we do know that for a lot of that time, the kings of Israel, meaning the northern kings, did not let, it was like East Berlin and West Berlin, if you remember that, they did not let Jews migrate to worship at the temple. The very first of the Israelite, when I say Israelite, I'm referring to the northern kings, is Yeravam ben Nevat. And Yeravam ben Nevat didn't want people to go to the south because that they would be giving loyalty to that other country. So instead, he put golden calves. Gee, we had some bad experiences with that before. But he made two golden calves in the city of Beis El that people would worship, idolatry, instead of going to the temple. So for many, many years, if you lived in the north, it was like North Korea, you know, or East Berlin, you could not go to the south to worship Hashem. But eventually, one of the Malchei Yisrael removed the Eglei Zahav and permitted Jews to go. And our tradition was that was on the 15th of Av, which is one of the reasons the 15th of Av was a very happy day. You may have heard of that. And one of the reasons is that the Jews of the north, 10 tribes, were given access to the temple. But shortly thereafter, the 10 tribes were conquered by Assyria. And that's how we get the idea of the lost 10 tribes. They kind of got lost to the Jewish people, 10 tribes. Now the Gemara asks the obvious question, wait a second here, something doesn't fit. This last king, Hoshea ben Ela was his name, he removes the Avodah Zarah. He gives Jews permission to go to the temple. He does a good thing. And that's when the 10 tribes get destroyed. For hundreds of years they're doing all sorts of sins. And then he finally does something good, and that's when Assyria comes in and destroys the 10 tribes. So here's what the Gemara said. He removed the guards and said, whoever wants to go to the temple can go to the temple. But nobody went. So all the years that there were guards and you couldn't go, so no, we have an excuse. If God asks us, why didn't you go to my temple? So I could say, although God really knows the answer anyway, but at least I could say externally, God, I couldn't do it. They wouldn't let me do it. But once you have the opportunity, which means, in other words, it's an interesting idea, enhanced opportunities for spirituality are both a blessing and sometimes a little bit of a curse, in the sense, I mean, let me give you an example. You know, now, it's much easier to learn Torah than it ever was. First of all, economically, everybody has enough food to eat virtually. But most Jews who are coming to learn Torah don't have questions of starvation. And there's more stuff in translation than ever before. And you can have chavrusas on telephone and Skype and internet, all sorts of stuff. So the opportunities for learning Torah, even for people without background, is much, much greater than you ever had before. And that's great. But that also means we got more responsibility. You know, if 50 years ago a person didn't study Torah, he might say, well, what can I do? I don't know Hebrew and I didn't learn Hebrew and there's nothing in English and, you know, what can I do? Even then there were ways of doing it. But, you know, today, what are you going to say? What do I do? I don't know Hebrew. Hashem will say, there was art scroll. You know, what do I do? I live 1,000 miles away from a chavrusa. Says there was Skype, you know. So the point basically is you have to understand that when Hashem gives you more opportunities, there is more responsibility. Okay. Now the 10 tribes were exiled around 120 years before the destruction of the temple, which means to say, the 10 tribes were gone, but the 2 tribes were still surviving in Yerushalayim. The king of Assyria wanted to destroy that as well. But according to our Chazal, there was a great miracle that 180,000 men of Sanherib, the king of Assyria, perished through angels destroying them at the gates of Jerusalem. And this miracle happened the night of Pesach. It's a later miracle. In other words, we know, of course, Pesach is the night that God took us out of Egypt. But a later miracle that is associated with Pesach, and now, with that date of Pesach, is that God destroyed Sanherib's army. So, the kingdom of Yehuda is limping along for another 120 years with the Beis HaMikdash. But then comes the king of Babylonia, who conquered Assyria first. Babylonia is, his territory is modern-day Iraq. Okay, so Iran is Persia. Iraq is ancient Babylonia. And the king that destroyed the temple was Nebuchadnezzar. Now the secular date that is given for the destruction of the first temple after 410 years, it's a very famous secular date, is 586 before the Common Era. That's the Christian form of dating before Yashka. Although why should we be using that date is a good question. But they used to say BC. BC actually meant before Christ. Now that's totally treif. BCE means before the Common Era, so at least you're not mentioning that explicitly. I don't want to go into dates too much now. I just want to tell you, however, that the 586 BCE is much too early to work with the chronology of Chazal. And the reason that's so, I'll tell you very quickly, is because according to Chazal, between the destruction of the first temple and the destruction of the second temple is 490 years, because the Babylonian exile was 70 and the second temple was 420. So from the destruction of the first to the destruction of the second was 490 years. Now we do know the second was destroyed in the year 70. Now the problem is, from 586 BCE to 70 CE is 586 plus 70. That's more than 600 years. It's almost 700 years, when in fact Chazal's chronology is only 490 years. And since the year 70 is very well established, that cannot really be debated. So the assumption must be that in Chazal's chronology, the destruction of the first temple was later, around 150 years later. I'm not going to answer this other than to note it is actually the biggest single problem in reconciling secular history and rabbinic chronology. And that is, when was the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash? Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash, we don't have any doubt. Okay. Now let me point out that the Babylonian exile only lasted 70 years, but it took place in two chunks. 11 years before the Churban, 11 years before the Churban, Nebuchadnezzar exiled the learned Talmidei Chachamim. He got them out. Now, why? What was he thinking? Is not really clear, but the hashtacha was that Hashem wanted the Torah scholars to be an advanced party to settle in Babylonia and be able to establish yeshivos, so that when the rest of the people came, there would already be an established Torah society. So this was 11 years before the Churban. You know, a very well-known person who was exiled at that time is none other than the Mordechai of the Purim story. He was exiled from the land of Israel 11 years before the destruction of the temple. Another famous person who was exiled 11 years before the destruction of the temple was the prophet Ezekiel. So you have to know, Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, lived at exactly the same time. But Yechezkel was the prophet in Babylonia, because he was there during the 11 years before the Churban. Jeremiah was actually in Eretz Yisrael at the time of the Churban. The Navi Yeshayahu, the other big prophet, right? These are the three gigantic prophetic books: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Isaiah was way before. Isaiah was at the time of the exile of the 10 tribes. In fact, Isaiah was a prophet in the northern kingdom. Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel were prophets of the southern kingdom, but Yechezkel had been exiled 11 years before. Okay. Be it as it may, though, so we have this 11 years, and then we have the Babylonian exile, and of course the destruction of the temple occurred on the 9th of Av, which is, you know, why we observe it as a fast day to this very day. And we hope, Mir Hashem, that this year we will not have to observe it as a fast day, that we should be Zocha to Mashiach and to the Beis HaMikdash and the like. But what happened during the 70 years of exile is some very important stuff. Number one, the Purim story happened. But before I get to the Purim story, I have to mention the following. The Babylonian Empire was toppled in a bloodless coup by the Persian Empire. And this is described in the book of Daniel in a very, very famous dramatic scene. Nebuchadnezzar had a son who ruled after him. His name was Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach had another son who ruled after him, Belshazzar. And Belshazzar, by the way, who happened to be Vashti's father, so a lot of the personalities intersect here. Belshazzar wanted to celebrate, arrogantly, his conquest of the Jewish people and his grandfather's destruction of the temple. So he made a big party with the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, the gold bowls and the knives, and he was celebrating that he vanquished God. He conquered the king of the Jews, so to speak. And in the middle of this riotous party, there's a gigantic finger that appears. And this phrase that is even entered the English language, handwriting on the wall, that inscribes a message on the wall. And nobody could read this message. This message was in the Hebrew letters that we have in the Sefer Torah. And the only one that could read it was Daniel. And the message of the handwriting on the wall was very, very ominous. Hebrew letters, Aramaic language. Mene, mene, tekal uparsin. Mene, mene means your deeds have been counted and weighed, and your kingdom shall be given to the Persians. That's pretty scary. I mean, you know, you're sitting there and all of a sudden this gigantic... But we say that Rishayim don't change their life no matter what they see. So Belshazzar just went to sleep after the party, decided to have a good night. And that night, unbeknownst to him, his servants had made a private deal with the Median king. Media was a province of Persia. And Belshazzar was just killed. And in a bloodless coup, except for his blood, he was the only one that died. There was no war here. In a bloodless coup, Persia took over. So Persia didn't conquer Israel, so to speak. Babylonia had conquered Israel. Persia just took over the Babylonian Empire. Now, the Persian king was Cyrus, Koresh. And Cyrus, and we're not clear, it's Machlokas, different opinions, was his intention to serve God, was his intention for himself. But he decided to issue a proclamation allowing all of the Jews to return to the land of Israel and rebuild the temple. King Cyrus. Now you may recall that, well, I don't know if you recall this, but you know, when the state of Israel was established in 1948, so anyone know the first nation that recognized the state of Israel? Somewhat bizarrely, and people still don't know the exact reason, it was Stalin. Stalin in Russia was the first person to recognize the state of Israel. There must have been some intention there, but we don't know exactly what his cheshbon was. But Harry Truman, the United States, was the second. And that was a little bit of a mesiris nefesh for him, because his own State Department was very pro-Arab, as they are to this very day. But Truman's best friend was a Jewish guy. They had a hat store that went bankrupt during the Depression before he was in politics. And this is Eddie Jacobson. That was his good buddy. And Eddie Jacobson, you know, kind of went in. He like barged into the White House because he could come in anytime he wanted. And he said to Truman, "You got to do this." So Truman said, "Get out of here, you know, Eddie. You know, just don't bother me. Everyone's telling me not to do it." He says, "No, Harry, I'm not leaving until you do it." You know, so basically, Truman did it. So he didn't want to do it, but like Jacobson made him do it. But Truman, the rest of his life, always called himself Cyrus. "I'm like Cyrus. I allowed the Jews to come back." So when all the United Jewish Appeals would make banquets honoring Harry Truman, and they would say how good he was, he would always like take their coat and shake it. "He didn't say I was Cyrus, you know, say that I'm Cyrus." Whatever. And Lamaita, I believe that Rav Aaron Cutler, that's how I'll actually use that lashon to him. He said, "You're like Koresh HaMelech that allowed the Jews to go back." So this was an amazing thing. But according to our tradition, and this is recorded in the book of Ezra, a bunch of non-Jews wrote letters to Cyrus and his successor, who was King Ahasuerus, that the Jews are building a temple in order to rebel against you. So Ahasuerus issued an edict. This is not in Megillas Esther, but this is in the book of Ezra. Not allowing the temple to be rebuilt. So Cyrus made his proclamation 52 years after the Churban. Ahasuerus withdrew Cyrus's proclamation. And the whole Purim story happened during that time. And it was 18 years, 52 plus 18 is 70, until they built the temple again. And what happened in the meantime was Ahasuerus died and was succeeded by King Darius, who allowed the temple to be built 70 years after its destruction. Okay, are you following? This is the idea of the Persian period and the like. Now, there's a beautiful irony here. Darius is a Persian king. Yes. Darius is the son of Ahasuerus. Yes. But according to rabbinic tradition, it's not in Tanakh, he was a child that he had from Queen Esther. So it turns out that the Persian king who allowed the temple to be rebuilt was actually Jewish. Now, I don't know if he was religious. I don't know if he even looked at himself as Jewish. Perhaps he didn't. But he was halachically Jewish, because if your mother is Jewish, you are Jewish. So just like people ask the question, was there a Jewish pope, etc., you know, there probably was, as a matter of fact. In fact, some say, well, the very first pope was Jewish. The very first pope was Peter. So Peter for sure was Jewish. And the like. His name was Shimon. But be it as it may, it is King Darius of Persia who authorized the building of the second temple. These were in the days of Ezra, Nehemiah, those great, great leaders. Now, according to our tradition, the second temple stood for 420 years. But here you need to know a few things about this. First of all, in spite of the fact that there was a temple now, most of the Jews did not come back to the land of Israel. Most of the Jews were comfortable in the diaspora. And what was Eretz Israel? It was desolate. It wasn't like today. You couldn't get Ben and Jerry's or Skippy peanut butter. Right? No, not even a good cell phone. Right? So life was, that's what I'm saying, it's kind of a joke. People complain now, you know, oh, it's so hard to live in Israel, you know, etc. I mean, it was hard then. I'm sorry, it truly was hard then. And most Jews didn't go. Now, they were criticized for it, but they didn't go. That's an important thing to know. But the second thing to know is this. Shortly after the Second Temple was built, there was another major world war in which the Persian Empire was conquered by the conqueror that we know as Alexander the Great, thereby initiating the Greek occupation of Eretz Israel. Alexander the Great was a world conqueror. He himself was not Greek, interestingly enough, but basically his culture was Greek and the like. And he created what you would call Hellenistic culture. He was not an anti-Semite. He was not like Antiochus, who comes later. He was benign in that way. But he did create what you would call cultural assimilation through Greek philosophy, Greek literature, Greek science, Olympic games, and the like. Eventually, Alexander was succeeded by people like Antiochus, who tried to force assimilation by coercion. Satri Alexander was not coercion, but nevertheless, he created much, much assimilation and intermarriage among the Jews. By the time the Hanukkah story comes, you have to know most of the Jews are already assimilated. It's not that Antiochus took them away from Hashem. So you see what we've done. We have the Babylonian period. We have the Persian period, which is relatively short. We have the Greek period, and that culminated in the revolt of the Maccabees, which established an independent Jewish state called the Hasmonean state. But the Hasmonean state is really a very tragic situation. Have any of you ever read George Orwell's Animal Farm? So if you know Animal Farm is a parody of the Russian Revolution, in which the animals are revolting in order to establish political freedom. But eventually, some of the animals become dictators, and they turn into the very bad thing that they were fighting against. That's the Russian Revolution. What? Stalin was some great humanitarian? So the Tsar was bad. Let's replace the Tsar and get Stalin. Are you really ahead, you know, in that? French Revolution, same story, right? So get rid of Louis the 16th, and you get Robespierre, you know, in Cambodia. You get rid of whoever it was. You get Pol Pot. You know, all in all, you're not really benefiting from that process. And Orwell made the point. Now, maybe the U.S. Revolution might be an exception. Hopefully,
we have Obama now.
Now, South, yeah, Obama. Okay, and South Africa itself. Okay, you can talk about South Africa itself. You have a very similar type of issue that one can discuss, but it's complicated. I wouldn't say it's in South Africa, but you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so the issue becomes this: the Hasmoneans revolted not for political reasons; they revolted because they wanted to create a society where Jews could practice Torah and do mitzvos and do bris milah and keep Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh. And that's why they revolted against the Antiochus. But you know what happened in the course of time? The Hasmonean kings, who initially were tzaddikim, they became Hellenists. They became persecutors of the sages. They became the mamish George Orwell. They became the very thing that they were fighting against. Be it as it may, therefore, and that is why, the way Chazal count it, you know, they count Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and then we'll see Rome. But what do you mean? Why Greece and then Rome? I mean, what about the Hashmonaim in the middle? The Hashmonaim is a Jewish state. No, they count it as Greece, that's all. They do not count the 150 years of Hasmonean rule as a Jewish thing. It is just a Hemshech of Yavon, which is very, very sad. But this, in other words, it's not counted as a Yiddish of Medina. It's Yavon. But eventually what happened was that the Romans conquered Eretz Yisrael from the Greeks. And not from the Greeks, from the Hasmoneans. And they installed someone that they thought was a Jew, who halachically was not a Jew. When the Romans conquered Palestine from the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, and that ended the Hasmonean rule, they put in as their flunky a man called Herod. Now Herod actually had been a slave of the Hasmoneans. He was connected to the Hasmonean family. But you know what they say? Herod was almost certainly a paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, the life of Herod is absolutely a soap opera, but a soap opera that unfortunately had many, many, many tragic repercussions for hundreds of thousands of people. Now, Herod, you know, they say even paranoids have enemies. You know, a paranoid thinks everybody is his enemy. In the case of Herod, everybody was his enemy. Herod was universally hated. He killed, forget about the Jews that he killed. He killed his wives and he killed his children. You know, he killed all sorts of people because he was convinced everybody was out to get him. And to some degree it was true because he was so hateful in this way. But Herod was a true schizophrenic in the following way. On one hand, he was brutal, paranoid. A person who... Now, one thing about Herod. Herod was not against religion per se. He says if the Jews want to keep their Torah in the mitzvahs... I mean, it's interesting. His thing was not religion. He didn't care about religion. His thing was political power. So it's interesting that Herod per se was not a persecutor of the sages, as long as they kept out of his way. And that is why you find in Pirkei Avos various references to don't get involved with the government. And a lot of those references I'm referring to, let's just not get involved with this guy, then maybe we can have our yeshivas. Hillel and Shammai were during his time. But Herod was a schizophrenic. You know, he killed, he was hated by everybody. But he was one of the great builders of the land of Israel. He built magnificent, in fact, a lot of the magnificence of Jerusalem of the Second Temple period. Maybe you'll see it at the Israel Museum, used to be the Holy Land Hotel, so they still call it the Holy Land exhibit, is Herodian architecture. He was really a master builder. And one of his projects, it's so amazing, was he wanted to redo the Second Temple. Now the Second Temple had already existed from the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. It was already 300 years old. 300 years old. But it was a simple structure. He made it the magnificent building that you're going to see models of and the like. So it's quite amazing that such a man who was such a Rasha, Hashem should give him the zechus of building the magnificent second temple that he built. And Chazal say, anyone that did not see the temple of Herod did not see a beautiful building in his life. But again, I want to point out that Herod's temple didn't last that much. Because Herod completed his temple, I think the exact date is, around 30 of the Common Era. So Herod's magnificent building only lasted 40 years. See, people don't understand this. Herod's temple is not the second temple for the entire 420-year period. It is only the second temple for the last few years, because eventually what happened was the Jewish people engaged in a revolt against Rome, and Rome destroyed the temple in order to put down the revolt, and later there was the Bar Kokhba revolt, etc., and the like. But this is the temple that you're going to see, the magnificent Herodian temple. And again, the Gemara quotes the sages as telling Herod because at some point Herod did kill a lot of the sages for political reasons. And they said to Herod, you have extinguished the light of the world, therefore you must build the temple, which is the light of the world. But it's still a question that, you know, you need to ponder. Why would Hashem give such a zechus to such a, you know, degenerate person, such a bad person? I mean, just to give you an example of how bad he was. Listen to this. The day that he died, he was dying. And he said, he knows people are going to rejoice when he dies, and no one is going to shed tears for his death. So he ordered several thousand people to be rounded up and killed at random, so people will be crying at his funeral. Not for him, they'll be crying for... I mean, you know, we can't even imagine that type of thing. Oh, no, we have people like that today, whether it's Saddam Hussein, you know, Assad, the guy in Syria, you know, there are people like that, that mindset even today. But this is Herod. This is the Herodian temple that you're going to see. But it's so amazing that the whole temple only lasted 40 years. Now, in the Christian Bible, which I normally don't use as a source, but that is the temple that Yashka visited. Do you remember the famous scene when he shows up and he overturns the moneylenders in the temple? Now, the moneylenders get a very bad rap here. One second. Why are there money changers in the temple? They're not loan sharks that, hey, you need a loan for, 150% interest. The halacha is, it's describing something that's al-pi halacha. Al-pi din. Every Jew has to give a half shekel, which is more than our half shekel, a half shekel every year for the korbanos, to buy the korbanos of the temple. That is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah in the Torah. Now, pilgrims would come to Eretz Yisrael for Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot. And if they didn't give their half shekel, they'd have to give their half shekel. But they come with a lot of different currencies. I don't have a half shekel. I have a dollar, and I have a franc, and I have a pound, and I have a rand. So there have to be money changers there to be able to take your foreign currency and give you a half shekel. This is a perfectly legitimate thing. So this crazy guy Yashka shows up and says, oh, money in the temple, and he throws over the tables and everything else. Yeah, he was crazy. Okay, whatever it would be. But there was nothing wrong with money. It's not money lenders, money changers in the temple. They had to be there for the mitzvah of the half shekel. But that was the temple that he visited. That's the Herodian temple. And as they say, it was destroyed in the year 70. Now, the person that destroyed it was the Roman general Titus, who shortly thereafter became emperor of Rome. And you may recall that there's a triumphal arch in Rome erected in honor of Titus, which at the top of the arch shows Jews being led in chains carrying the menorah. But you've seen pictures of that. And there's a caption, Judea Captiva, the Jews have been captured. And they say there's a tradition, I'm not sure if there's a makor for this, that a Jew that's in Rome does not walk under the Arch of Titus, because you don't want to give honor to one that is celebrating the destruction of the temple and the like. And the Jewish historian of the time, we have a few sources for how the temple got destroyed in the year 70. We have a number of accounts in Chazal, Gemara and Medrash. And then we have Josephus, who was a Jew who lived at that time. And Josephus is kind of the Benedict Arnold. He kind of went over to Rome, but then he wrote a history of the Jews. And Josephus claims he wrote the history because he wanted the Jewish people to come out looking good, dignified, and great. But you have to take everything he says with a grain of salt, because he was living under the protection of Titus, so he really couldn't write anything bad against the Romans. But he writes one thing about Titus. Now, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. In our tradition, Titus is portrayed as a very bad guy who fornicated with a prostitute in the Holy of Holies. Bad, bad Russia. Josephus says, well, Titus is really a nice guy. He didn't want to destroy the temple. The soldiers made him do it. They were an uncontrollable mob. He wants to take the blame off Titus, but we understand that. He's living in Titus's house in Rome. He can't really write that part of it. But there's one thing he quotes about Titus that I suspect might be true. And you have to know that in the years before the destruction of the temple, Jews were fighting among themselves. And I don't just mean, you know, saying names of each other. They were shooting arrows. They were fighting for control and domination. Josephus describes a scene where the Kohanim were bringing korbanos in the temple, and arrows and spears were being thrown above their heads from one side to the other, in which warring factions of Jews were trying to control the temple, while the Kohanim are kind of going under them to bring korbanos. That's the meaning of when we say the temple was destroyed because of hatred. It's literally meant that. So, here's what Josephus says. He says that Titus told him, when Titus saw all this stuff, he says, you know, maybe I don't have to destroy the temple. If I just wait long enough, the Jews will destroy it themselves. I don't know. I mean, a lot of what Josephus says may not be true, is not true. I have a little bit of a suspicion that that may have been a true statement, because that corresponds to what Chazal say, that the hatred and the polarization that exists with Am Yisrael caused the destruction of the Second Temple. And of course, let me just end with this. The Talmud Yerushalmi says, any generation in which the temple is not rebuilt is as guilty as the generation of its destruction. So if the temple was destroyed because of hatred, the temple is not rebuilt because we still have that hatred and polarization. And the only way we'll be zocheh to have a binyan beis hamikdash is when we can overcome the hatred and the barriers and the polarization, and then create achdus and unity in Avos Yisrael. So I hope that you'll enjoy your tour, and it'll bring back a lot of extra supplementary information. So we all take
care. Some of the boys were asking in terms of Kriya.
Yeah.
In terms of what they should do, what the options are.
Well, there are a few options. It is proper to do Kriya. That's 100%. Yeah.
What's Kriya?
Kriya is ripping. You tear over your heart in memory, in mourning and memory. However, if you don't want to do that, then there is an Eitzah in which each person transfers ownership of their shirt to the other. Now, that doesn't mean you have to switch shirts. And let's say, for example, if I want the Jew to own my sweater, so what you can do is you give me a pen, which I can give back to me later, and by a symbolic barter, when I take the pen, you own my sweater. Now, that means I'm not wearing my sweater, I'm wearing your sweater. Now, the halacha is, if you are wearing a garment you do not own, if I'm wearing somebody else's shirt, I don't have to rip kriya. So through the symbolic kinyan chalipin, everybody could transfer their shirts. So as I say, it is better to do kriya because it does show that you care. But if that would be difficult for you, do a kinyan, and then it's not your shirt, and then you're okay. Now, it's interesting. There's an interesting rule that people who live... Now, technically, every 30 days you do Kriya. In other words, if you didn't see the kotel for 30 days, you would rip again. And yet, it's brought down that many poskim say people who live in Jerusalem do not have to rip their garments. They rip it the first time they come, and then they don't have to rip afterwards. Because, again, the idea is, unfortunately, a person becomes habituated, meaning, you know, you live here, so unfortunately you take everything for granted, even the fact that we have a Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Now, it's such an amazing thing. We have so much joy when we see the Kotel. But, and you know, rightfully so, but it's also a source of tremendous sadness that on the Temple Mount we have mosques and Avodah Zarah. Okay, I mean, technically not Avodah Zarah, because Islam is not Avodah Zarah, but certainly it's not the Beis HaMikdash. And what is the Kaisel but a remnant? It's not even a remnant of the temple. The Kaisel is a remnant of the walls around the Temple Mount. That is not the temple. Right? That's not the temple at all. So in many, many ways, this is something that inspires sadness and prayer that Hashem should give us the Gula. Yeah, but that would be the way that you could avoid the application of Kriya. There are other ways. Some people say that this won't happen to you, but if you would go Erev Shabbos after the middle of the day, you don't do Kriya. On the other hand, Rebbe Yashuv didn't like that hetter, but that was a hetter that was widely followed. But if you're going today, you do have to do Kriya ripping unless you follow the Eitzah that I gave.
What about on Shabbos?
on Shabbos you also don't do kriyas. So that would be, so if your first visit is on Shabbos, that would be an example of not having to tear. Even after Shabbos, not having to tear.
And if you do like trade your shirt, do you have to do it even if it wasn't in 30 days? Even if you go not in 30 days, do you have to tear or swap your shirt again?
No. If you go within 30 days of the first visit, you do not have to swap your shirt again.
Okay.
Because it's still within 30 days. If you go after 30 days, you have to do the ritual again. Okay, you all take care, and again, welcome, and come back often.
Thank you so much. Thank you.